And now, Virgin Most Powerful Radio is pleased to present Hands-On Apologetics with renowned Catholic author and apologist, Gary Matsuda.
And welcome, everybody. Hands-On Apologetics. You have entered into Virgin Most Powerful's Apologetics Dojo. And I am your host, Gary Matsuda, and your sensei and just all-around good friend. And we're diving into the world of defending, explaining the Catholic faith with clarity, charity, and confidence. And it's great to be with you today. Thank you for tuning in. Got a great show in store for you. You know, it's been a fun week. Lots of great guests, and you know, the fun continues because today's guest is none other than, wait for it, Trent Horn from Catholic Answers. Trent's going to come on board. We're going to try something that we haven't done in the past, and that is Trent's going to download some great information on pro-life apologetics. And you know, boy, today more than ever, we need to be able to give good, clear, concise answers to objections, you know, on the pro-life lines, and also be able to persuade people. And no one, I think, does it better than Trent Horn, who has been in the trenches, been on college campuses, been talking to people, and he's just a great apologist in his own right. And so that's what we're going to do. On the other side of the first break, Trent Horn's going to come on. We're going to talk about pro-life apologetics. And if you have any questions for Trent, please give us a call at 888-526-2151. That's 888-526-2151. Love to hear from you. And I also want to give a shout out to those watching on social media, live stream on Facebook and YouTube. Hello, everybody. Oh, Pauline, thank you very much for the emoji explosion. I appreciate it. And hello to everybody else out there and to you listening on radio, podcast, or, you know, just surfing the web and coming across us. You know, it's amazing how many people listen to the program, not only in the United States, but even outside the United States. So welcome all. And, you know, I need to say this before we jump into our usual exercises for today. A while back, we had Arthur and Teresa Beam on the show. You might remember that they are former Seventh-day Adventists who converted to Catholicism. And we actually had a couple of shows on Seventh-day Adventism, you know, trying to understand their worldview, how they view the Catholic Church, and how, you know, Catholics can reach Seventh-day Adventists, you know, to answer their objections, share the faith with them. And they are just a treasure trove of information. Well, anyway, I got an email from them. And on the show, they mentioned that they're developing a series of videos that Arthur and Teresa are going to put on YouTube that's really made for, tailor-made for Seventh-day Adventism to explain Catholicism to them. Like I said, they know both worlds so well, and they're so articulate. And they're just down-to-earth great people, you know, so they're fun to listen to. It's not, you know, somebody that has a on-air persona. They're just them, and it's good stuff. Well, anyway, I want to tell you that their series is now available on YouTube. So if you go on YouTube and you search for Arthur and Teresa Beam, B-E-E-M. Wait, that's two E's, B-E-E-M. Just search for Arthur and Teresa Beam, and you can locate them. And I watched a few videos yesterday, and it's good stuff. Now, remember, it's geared towards Seventh-day Adventists, but, you know, you can always make notes about how they use terminology, how they approach things, because they understand, you know, the worldview of the Seventh-day Adventists. They understand the lingo. And so they're able to explain it in their own language, so to speak. So it's good stuff. And so, you know, I'm going to have Arthur and Teresa back on the show because I find it very fascinating. Seventh-day Adventist is a very interesting Protestant group indeed. And it's also very prevalent. So it's, you know, one that you will encounter, and you need to be able to give some good answers for the hope that's in you. So that's what we're all about, folks, here on Hands-On Apologetics. So, as always, we do our critical thinking skills, and we meet an early church father of the episode. Today, the finding of the fallacy is called the quantitative fallacy. It's also known, by the way, as the McNamara fallacy, and it's named after Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense in the United States from 1961 to 1968. And basically, it involves making a decision based solely on quantitative, that's measurable, observations or metrics, and then ignoring everything else. And that I know that was one of the main criticisms of McNamara's direction in the Vietnam War, was that he was focused almost exclusively on measurable, quantitative metrics, and trying to win the war by numbers while ignoring lots of other things that can't be quantified. Well, if you go to Wikipedia, which I don't recommend generally, but nevertheless, they do have some, you know, some good stuff that you can use. They have this great quote from, boy, I hope I pronounced the name right, Daniel Lekovich, Corporate Priorities and Continuing Study on New Demands on Business. But he really gives a great explanation of how this this fallacy works. Okay, so let me just read it to you. It says the first step is to measure whatever can easily be measured. And he says this is okay as far as it goes. The second step is to disregard that which is not easily measured or to give it an arbitrary quantitative value. And he says this is artificial and misleading. The third step is to presume that what can't be measured easily really isn't important. And he says this is blindness. The fourth step is to say that what can't be easily measured really doesn't exist. And he says this is suicide. So you can kind of see this is one of those fallacies, I think, that beats deep in the heart of this idea of scientism, that you know, unless it's proven by science, it's not good data. And even like it may not even exist. It's off the radar screen completely. So it's good to know this fallacy. And once again, defining the fallacy is the quantitative fallacy or the McNamara fallacy. All right. So why don't we jump to Meet the Early Church Father segment. Today's Early Church Father is known as the Ambrosiaster, who was a person that flourished between AD 366 and 384. Okay. So now this is an interesting Early Church Father because we're not really sure who he is. Okay, it basically is this. There was a commentaries on the 13 epistles of Paul, and notice that it didn't include Hebrews, that was commonly included among the writings of St. Ambrose. Okay, so it was part of the tradition of St. Ambrose's work. Well, it was Erasmus of Rotterdam who noticed that, you know, this doesn't read like Ambrose. In fact, it probably isn't Ambrose, even though it's usually included with Ambrose's works. So Erasmus gives the name of this unknown author Ambrosiaster, which basically is pseudo-Ambrose. Okay, so we have Ambrosiaster, which is not even a name. It's just pseudo-Ambrose. Okay, so what do we know about this work? Well, the work originated in Rome around the time of Pope Damasus I, who reigned between AD 366 384. You might recall Pope Damasus is the one who commissioned St. Jerome to make a fresh translation of the Bible into Latin, known as the Vulgate, which later became the official translation of the Catholic Church. So anyway, it originated right around this time, and it can be dated, really, we can't be more specific about it. Part of the manuscript tradition, like I said, attributes the commentary Romans. Not only is it was it in the name of Ambrose, but it's also attributed to, interesting enough, a Hilary. Now, it's presumed, perhaps, that this could be Hilary of Poitiers, which if you call, you know, a few shows ago, we did this great doctor of the church, Hilary of Poitiers. But, scholars aren't so sure that's the correct Hilary. Attempts have been made to identify Ambrosiaster with a deacon named Hilary who was part of a sect known as the Luciferian. Now, let me tell you, Luciferian, when I talk about this, this is not a demonic cult. Okay, that's the modern Luciferians. This is actually a group of heretics that followed a person named Lucifer in the 4th century. They were actually very, very orthodox. In fact, they're quite rigorous Catholics. So it could be this deacon named Hillary. Or it's also possible that it could be from a person that we know about who is a Jewish person named Isaac. Okay, Isaac the Jew. What we know about this person named Isaac was that he grew up Jewish. He converted to Christianity, and eventually he left. Okay, so he returned back to Judaism, and before he left, he made all sorts of slanderous accusations against Pope Damasus. Now, you ask yourself, well, how come it's not, why is it Hillary instead of Isaac? Well, some scholars believe that perhaps it's because the Jewish name Isaac means laughter. And in Latin, it would be gaudentius, laughter or joy. So they think that, you know, Hillary might be like a Latinized version of his baptismal name. So, you know, that's a possibility who Ambrosiaster is. We're not really sure. There's also another work in Augustine that's not part of his authentic works called 127 Questions on the Old and New Testaments. This also is probably the work of this Ambrosiaster, whoever he is. So that's our Meet the Early Church Father today, Ambrosiaster. Coming up on the other side of the break, we're going to talk with Master Apologist Trent Horn about pro-life apologetics. You don't want to miss it. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This is Terry Barber reminding you, there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity, be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
In Luke 7, Jesus said, "I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven her, because she has been shown great love." According to St. John of the Cross, Christians should always remember that the value of their good works is not based on number and excellence. Their value is based on the love for God that prompts them to do the works. May we always be motivated by true love for God, and not worry so much about what we do, but why we do it.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back, everybody. Hands-On Apologetics. We are going to talk about pro-life issues, especially how to explain, defend the faith, how to persuade people about the pro-life message, and to help us do that, I can think of no better person than Master Apologist Trent Horn. Trent Horn is a convert to the Catholic faith. Trent earned a master's degree in theology from the Franciscan University of Steubenville and a master's degree in philosophy at Holy Apostles College, and he's pursuing a master's degree in bioethics at the University of Mary. He's a staff apologist at Catholic Answers. He's also an adjunct professor of apologetics at Holy Apostles College, and he also wrote several awesome books, such as Answering Atheism, The Case for Catholicism, Why We're Catholic, and his latest book is Counterfeit Christ, Finding the Real Jesus Among the Imposters. And Trent Horn, welcome to Hands-On Apologetics.
Thank you for having me, Gary. It's good to be here, and it's very appropriate to talk about pro-life, because Todd, our editor, just dropped on my desk a Polish version of my book, Persuasive Pro-Life. So it's wonderful to see that here. A lot of my books have been translated overseas, and it's helpful for the places where abortion actually is illegal and people are trying to campaign to have it become legal.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, that's fantastic. Congratulations. Talk about being influential beyond the borders. That's great.
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce it. It's Persuasive Pro-Life in English. It's I'm going to butcher this, but Brezhkonyak Dojiczka, Jacques Romaszek o Aborski. So I'm sure your Polish listeners can tell me what I butchered. But
well, I'm part Polish, and it's tough. There's not very many vowels.
There's not a lot of vowels, and I think everyone likes to throw the Zs, the Ys, and the Ks in there a lot, pretty liberally.
That's true. That's true.
Those are the Scrabble board. But it's great.
Awesome. Well, yeah. In fact, we'll definitely have to mention that book again at the end of the program. But, I mean, as I mentioned in the intro, I don't know if a lot of people, we're familiar with you from Catholic Answers, but, you know, before you got onto the staff, you did a lot of pro-life work, didn't you?
I did. I traveled the country with a pro-life organization called Justice for All. And I did that shortly after college, and I would go to university campuses. We set up exhibits, photo exhibits of pictures of the unborn before and after abortion. And so I set those up, and we would dialogue with students, and I got a lot of practice doing that. And that's kind of really where I got my teeth cut on the art of dialogue and apologetics. I talked about abortion, but I also talked about atheism and Christianity with college students. So I did a lot of apologetic practice just right there. On university campuses, really in the trenches, talking to people. So it's, you know, the real deal here. A lot of people can study apologetics and you just read books and that's all you do. But until you get out there and you actually talk to people, you don't get a good feel for what it's really like.
Yeah, field work is so important, you know. Now, when you were doing that, was it like, were you doing formal talks or was this just one-on-one conversations?
They were one-on-one conversations, so sometimes we would set up a microphone, and you know, we'd have a crowd of like 50, 100 people show up, and some were protesting, and I would engage them with a microphone and kind of have dialogue with them back and forth. And I took that, what I learned from that experience, to Catholic Answers, doing our shows like Why Are You Pro-Choice? Why Are You an Atheist? When I do Why Are You Pro-Choice, the show on Catholic Answers Live, where people can call in if they're pro-choice and I talk with them, it's a real throwback to when I used to do those open microphone sessions on university campuses. It's almost the same thing. It's just less tense because there aren't a big crowd of people yelling at you. But a lot of the dynamics are still pretty similar.
Yeah, so you were almost like the Frank Sheed of like modern pro-life movement.
Yeah, it was similar. He'd go to Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park and we'll go out. And people still do that, actually, in London and a few other cities. But yeah, just to go out and have kind of these open air debates with people. And so you learn the art of quickly and succinctly making your point and asking a question that quickly reveals the inanity of your opponent's position.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, very good. Yeah, so I think the first thing I'd like to talk about is the initial fear. I think there's a fear of defending pro-life cause because basically of the hostile, you know, throwback, like when you were doing your talks. How do you get over that fear?
Well, you mean the fear of, like, addressing a hostile audience?
Yeah, or even family or, you know, friends.
Oh, sure. Well, I think that the way you get over it is that when you know the material well, then you're more at ease with sharing it. But the only way to get over it is just to do it. There's really no other way. I mean, I was a lot more nervous the first time I did dialogues or first time I did a public debate. But the more and more you do it, the easier it becomes to share. But a lot of it's familiarity. When you're familiar with not just your position, but other people's position, you almost know what they're going to say before they say it. And so you can be aware of that, and then you can guide the conversation gently to where you want it to go to lead that person to the truth.
Right. Yeah, very good. Yeah. So where do we start? What should we know? What basic objections will we encounter?
Well, when it comes to the issue of abortion, I find what's most important is not necessarily teaching pro-lifers how to answer every single objection, but rather to give them a framework to know where they need to go when the objections rise. And the most important thing a pro-life advocate can remember is this: they must always bring the conversation back to a single question. And that question is, what are the unborn? What are they? They're not human beings, abortion doesn't really matter. But if the unborn are human beings, then nothing can justify abortion any more than you could justify killing a toddler because they're, you know, we're living in an impoverished or difficult situation. And so that's the key there, is to gently always get it back to that question, to force the other person to answer it. What are the unborn and how are you treating them? And so I give people various tips and strategies for how to get the conversation there. I use a strategy called trot out a toddler, which I can explain more a little bit later, that basically just gets us away from the reasons to justify abortion that have nothing to do with what the unborn are, like choice or privacy or overpopulation. Instead, gets us to focus on that main critical issue of what the unborn are, and then the conversation can be much more fruitful.
Yeah, yeah. So you don't actually, that helps a lot, because you don't have to worry about, well, what if they, you know, appeal to overpopulation, or what if they appeal to something like that? At least you know you can guide them down a path that you're prepared to talk about.
That's right. And so the path, it basically goes like this. If someone gives an argument for abortion that has nothing to do with what the unborn are, you can say, does this argument tell me what the unborn are? No, like overpopulation, it doesn't do that. There's a four-step pattern I teach people. It's called Trot at a Toddler. It was named by my friend and mentor, Scott Klusendorf. And it basically has four steps: agree, apply, ask why, and awe. So you first just agree, yeah, the situation you raise has difficulties, whether it's the impoverished family or there's a lot of people in the world, there's overpopulation. But then you apply it. You just apply it to a two-year-old and say, well, could we kill a two-year-old because the world's overpopulated? Could we kill a two-year-old because his parents are poor? And people will say, well, no, you can't do that. And say, well, why not? So agree, apply, ask why. Well, why can't you do that? Oh, because a two-year-old's a human being. You can't kill people. And the last step is ah. Oh, okay. So that's the issue. It's not really about overpopulation, because we agree you can't kill a born person for this reason. If the unborn are just as human as a two-year-old, you can't treat them the same way. Now, this isn't the whole pro-life argument. It just gets us back to the one question, what are the unborn? Because people will say, well, they're not like two-year-olds. Okay, good. That's what I want to talk about. I don't want to talk about overpopulation. I want to talk about what the unborn are. And that's the key to move the conversation.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, so there's a direction we need to take them into. And what's your experience doing that? Is it pretty easy to take them down that series of steps? Or do people realize that you're leading them to a corner and they fight you on it?
Well, most people see where they'll say things like on the radio, they'll say things like, okay, I see where you're going. Uh-huh. And I'll say, well, where am I going? Because I want them to spell it out for me. Or they'll become repetitive. They'll go from overpopulation to the right to choose, to back alley abortion, to rape. And the process repeats itself over and over again, but just with different reasons applied to the killing of a two-year-old, because they don't want to talk about what the unborn are. So it can be a bit frustrating, but you have to keep always guiding people back to the question that they don't want to answer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, because like you said, it really does come down to that. You know, what is the value of human life, and whether or not you could legitimately take the life of an innocent and helpless person, right? I mean, that's the ultimate goal.
Right. And then that's the key here, that if the unborn are just as innocent and helpless and deserving of basic rights as a toddler or as you or I, then we have a moral duty to protect them just as we would protect anybody else. And then the conversation moves on to when people say, well, they're not like 2-year-olds, they're not like you or I. That's true. That's true. The unborn are not like us. They are different. But the key here is to show that the difference between us and the unborn is morally irrelevant. There are differences, but the differences are as morally trivial as the differences between people's race, their skin color, sexual or, you know, sex, whatever it may be.
Yeah. So, because someone could say, well, you know, physically a toddler is different than an unborn baby. Unborn baby is, you know, that's they probably wouldn't even say baby, but they would say, you know, that's a product of
usually fetus or embryo.
Yeah. It's part of the female anatomy, you know, and a toddler is self-sustaining and separate. And, you know, you're really comparing apples with oranges.
Well, and here, what I would say here is, no, it's more like comparing, you know, freshly budding oranges to fully bloomed oranges, or, you know, it's more like comparing a sapling to a tree, because you'll hear that one all the time. It's a classic one. An acorn's not an oak tree, and a fetus isn't a person. An egg isn't a chicken. The problem here is that an acorn, if it is fertilized, it is a very, very small oak. Otherwise, it's just a seed. But when an acorn is germinated, I should say, you have the beginnings of an oak tree right there. It's not an oak tree, but it's the very beginnings of it. You have a very immature oak. An egg that's not fertilized is not a chicken, no doubt about that. But I have tried a Philippine tree called balut, B-A-L-U-T, which is a fertilized duck egg. And I will tell you, my friend, that is an actual duck in there. Its crunchiness certainly gives it away. That is a very immature duck that's present. So a fertilized egg is a very small chicken. So the analogy that an acorn isn't an oak is not a fetus isn't a person. It's just an acorn, a germinated acorn or a fertilized chicken egg is not a chicken or an oak tree, in the same way that a fetus is not an adult. And that is completely true. That is true. They're all organisms in very immature stages of life, but they're still that kind of organism. So our goal is to show, one, the unborn is a human organism, not a part of the mother's body. It's alive. It's growing. It has human DNA. It's different from the mother's DNA. And it's a whole organism developing. That's science. Then after science, we do philosophy to show, yeah, there's these differences. The unborn are dependent. They're smaller. But those differences, as I said before, are morally trivial. They don't justify killing the unborn.
Very good. We're chatting with Master Apologist Trent Horn about pro-life apologetics. More to come on the other side of the break. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Barbara Nicolosi, and we're having a women's conference here at the Sacred Heart Chapel in Covina on September 7th, 2019. This is going to be a great, great day for you to come and meet a bunch of new friends, wonderful Catholic women who want to deepen their Catholic faith and their understanding of themselves as women. You know, this era right now that we're in, so much confusion. What is it to be a man? What is it to be a woman? You know, the Catholic Church has a lot to say about this, and we're going to hear about them. We're going to hear about John Paul II's letter on women that he wrote from Mary Danielle Barber. She's going to talk about that. She's going to talk about Mary as a model for all of us. It's a topic that we can never reflect on too much. I'm going to talk about Teresa of Avila and the interior castle and how a mystical marriage is what all of us should be called to, or are called to, as Catholics in our prayer lives, and especially as women in the church. Aileen Blakowski is going to talk about motherhood and homeschooling. And then finally, we have Father Charles Murray. He's going to be the celebrant of the Eucharist. He's going to be here hearing confessions. It's going to be an amazing day. We're going to have an hour of adoration together, time to pray, time to laugh and eat, reflect, grow in our passion for our Catholic faith and our identity as Catholic women. You don't want to miss it. You want to come. You want to bring your friends. You want to bring your daughters, your nieces. That's really an affordable day. So go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org and you can register for this conference, or call 877-526-2151. The Women's Conference is going to be a great event for the Archdiocese of Los Angeles area, Southern California Catholics. You don't want to miss it.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show, and they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
This is Jesse Romero. You're listening to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda on Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
And welcome back, everybody. We're chatting with Trent Horn about pro-life apologetics. And Trent, you know, right before the break, you were showing us that, you know, we should be directing our conversation ultimately down to the question of the unborn baby. Is it human or not? What is it? And you actually brought up one way in which they try to skirt the humanity issue by comparing an egg to a chicken and so on and so forth. Are there any other ways that they try to slip out of that that knot?
Well, there's slogans that are thrown out there, things like, well, this is just a clump of cells. And I would say that could also describe you or me. And say, well, no, it's a clump of cells that can't think or feel. Okay, now we're getting to concrete differences here. Before I get to the differences, let me just dispatch some of these other slogans. Another common one is, well, it's not human, it's an embryo or fetus. When someone says that, I challenge them to say, well, define a fetus or embryo. What do those words mean? What are you talking about? What are these things? Because when you look them up in a dictionary definition, it says for human beings, an embryo is a human being from conception until the seventh week of life, and a fetus is a human being from the eighth week of life until birth. The biological case that the unborn are just small members of the human species is virtually unassailable. Intelligent people on the pro-choice side, philosophers like Peter Singer or David Boonin, will easily concede this is, of course, a biological human being like you or I. What they and many others will object to, they'll say, well, it's not a person, not a full human who deserves the same rights that you and I have. And here we should challenge again and say, first, what is a person? In order for you to say the unborn are not persons, you'd have to know what a person is first, much the same way I know my desk is not a circle because I know what a circle is. It has one side. My desk has four sides. So when they make the claim the unborn is not a person, they have to have a definition of what a person is. And we have to try to show that definition is ad hoc. It's been constructed to simply, it's arbitrary, constructed to disqualify the unborn. So challenge them with that first. And then what I do is I take people through an acronym that shows the differences between us and the unborn and why those differences aren't morally relevant.
Okay. Yeah. Very good. So it comes down to, fine. If you can have a human being who's not a person, then how do you define a person? And so they have
right.
to. So how do you uncover that it's totally ad hoc? You know, they'll come up. I'm sure they have lots of explanations about, you know, well, a person has to be A, B, C, and D. Walk us through that. How would we address that?
Well, you have to show, you have to apply their definition of what a person is. You want to apply that and say, all right, does it either include non-persons or does it exclude persons? Or is it just arbitrary? Is it something that has just been crafted simply to get rid of the unborn without any reason behind it? So Stephen Schwartz is a philosopher, and he has shown there are four differences between us and the unborn. And he summarizes it with the acronym SLED, S-L-E-D, SLED.
Okay.
So size, the unborn are smaller than we are. But, you know, so what? I mean, and a good way to compare this is with a newborn infant. Newborns and preemies are very small. Doesn't mean they're not persons. How big do you have to be a person? L stands for level of development. The unborn can't think or feel like us. So what? There are born people that can't think or feel like us, people in comas. And I would say reversible comas, because you don't want to pick an example that's controversial, like an irreversible coma, but a reversible coma or a deep sleep or a disabled person. A newborn baby can't think like a rational adult. It can't even think at a higher level than a dog or a pig, but they're still persons. So size, level development is L. E stands for environment. So the unborn are in a mother's body. They haven't been born yet. Well, so what? Me moving 8 inches across my office doesn't make me a non-person. The baby traveling 8 inches through the birth canal doesn't make them a person. So environment's irrelevant. Now, what they'll say is, well, it's not environment. It's degree of dependency. It's the idea that, well, the fetus is totally dependent on the mother's body, so it's not a person. And here we have to ask, why? Why does that matter? Why does that matter? So what? We're all dependent in one way, shape, or form. A newborn baby left on a hospital table will die in a few hours if no one tends to him. My friend David Lee gives this great analogy. Imagine you have a two-year-old falls in a swimming pool. You're the only one around who can save him. He's totally dependent on you. Does he stop being a person? And the answer is no. Our dependency does not change our fundamental identity or our value. So when you look at those four differences, size, level of development, environment, degree of dependency, SLED, the differences are real, but they don't justify treating the unborn in a way we would never treat a toddler, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. I, you know, with the S for size, I mean, for me, well, you met me, Trent. Pretty much everybody is smaller than me. So it'd be wrong for me to say you're not human.
You do tower above us, indeed, Mr. Machuda.
Yeah, of the four, I think, well, what do you think most people would think would be the most persuasive of SLED? That the most tricky or the one that they would say, well, yeah, that's obviously the crux of the issue. Would it be dependency?
I think dependency is a really big one for people. And part of the reason for that, and this might bleed over into our next segment here, but we can still go with it,
okay,
is that people have this idea, they have this muddled thinking. Well, first, dependency is the biggest difference between us and the unborn. And if it's just dependency itself, we should show that that's just completely arbitrary. People say things like, well, they're not viable. What do you mean they're not viable? Yeah, the unborn are not viable outside of the womb. But that'd be like, imagine if a Martian took you off planet Earth and put you on Mars, and you would, of course, die because there's not enough oxygen on Mars. And the Martian said, well, that's not really murder because Earthlings aren't viable. Well, that's silly. Earthlings are viable on Earth. That's, you kill us if you take us from Earth to Mars. It's the same with the unborn. If you take them out of the womb before they can survive, you kill them. You place them in a hostile environment. So when people will say these things, they'll just point out the difference. Well, they can't survive on their own. So what? That just shows they need us and we have a duty to help them. Where it bleeds over is when people say, well, even if it is a person, because it's totally dependent, that baby does not have a right to use his mother's body, which gets into things that are called bodily rights arguments, which are kind of the new frontier people are relying on because it's just patently obvious that the unborn are human beings and that they are persons. And so people try to say, even if they are persons, they don't have the same rights that you and I have.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So that's kind of like the next step that now that the older arguments have become kind of archaic and no longer serviceable. Now it's in terms of rights and, you know, that they don't have the right to access their mother's body, that type of thing.
Right. That they'll say, well, just as a woman can do, there's two variants of this argument that a woman can do, or a person, I should say, because of all the transgender nonsense, I actually don't hear women a lot. A lot of people have not gotten mad at me about being a man, actually. They don't say, well, you're a man, you have no opinion about this, because now men can get pregnant, apparently. So ironically, I haven't heard that objection a lot in recent years. But what they'll say is that a person can do whatever he or she wants with their body. Usually they say women, though. I mean, women should be able to do whatever they want with their bodies. Therefore, you know, they should be able to have abortion. So that's a very controversial claim. That means you have the right to take drugs that directly cause birth defects, and there's nothing morally wrong with that at all. Or you'd have the right to take a healthy baby out of an incubator, put them back into a woman's body, and she could have an abortion, even though the child was alive and healthy outside of the womb 5 minutes ago, which is absurd. So that variant of the argument is bad. The other one is the idea that Yeah, I don't know if you ever heard of the Thompson violinist argument.
No, I haven't.
No, you'll get it on college campuses all the time. It's actually a very famous thought experiment. So it goes like this. From Judith Jarvis Thompson, 1971, so before Roe v. Wade, she says, look, even if the fetus is a person, the fetus may not have a right to use a woman's body, for example. And she gives a kind of silly scenario, but it's a philosophical thought experiment. Imagine you wake up one day and you're plugged into a famous unconscious violin player, and you've been kidnapped by the Society of Music Lovers, and your kidneys are being used to keep the violinist alive. And you got to stay plugged into him for 9 months or he'll die. Many people would say, well, it would be great to stay plugged in, but no one should force me to stay plugged in against my will. And then people say, well, if you can unplug from the violinist, why can't a pregnant woman unplug from her unborn child? And so this is an argument by analogy. And arguments by analogy fall apart when the analogy becomes disanalogous. And you say, wait a minute, there's important differences here. And that's our goal in refuting this argument, is to show, wait a minute, there's a big difference between being kidnapped by the Society of Music Lovers and plugged into an unconscious violinist's kidneys and a pregnant mother. The differences are insurmountable, and so the argument doesn't work. And so I'm sure you can take a guess at some of those differences.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Well, I've got a couple of minutes. Why don't we just pull that apart before the break?
Let's do that then. So the differences include, one, the primary one is responsibility. I'm not responsible for the violinist needing my body, but in 99% of cases, a man and woman did something they knew would bring a child into existence. So they owe that child compensation and care. That's why, for example, if we have the moral intuition that men owe child support, even if they don't want to be parents anymore, then mothers owe support in the form of their body to provide for this child. And that covers, 99% of cases. And many college students will agree with me. Yeah, if you do that, you're responsible for the child. I get that. But some people will say, yeah, but what about in the case of rape, for example? It's not the same. I'll say, well, there's still other key differences. The other two key differences are these. In the violinist example, when I unplug from the violinist, I'm not killing the violinist. I'm refusing to save his life. He was already dying from kidney failure. He was sick. He was dying. I'm returning him to that dying state. If you unplug from the fetus, abortion is a euphemism to say unplug, you don't return the fetus to a dying state. You take a healthy child and kill him or her by ripping them out from their mother's womb. So it's not the same thing at all. You are killing versus letting someone die or refusing to save them. And finally, my kidneys are made from my body. They're not made for anyone else. It would be extraordinary for me to be forced to use my kidneys to keep someone else alive. But the uterus is a natural organ for the child. It has a right to it, much the same way that a newborn has a right to his mother's breast if the alternative is starvation.
Very good. Awesome. We're talking with Trent Horn, pro-life apologetics. More to come on the other side of the break. Stay tuned, folks.
Welcome, Daniel. You're on the line. What's on your mind, brother?
Hi, I just wanted to share a testimony about Virgin Most Powerful Radio. I had a buddy at work who, he's a lukewarm Catholic guy, and I wanted him to start listening to the Terry and Jesse show, so I kept telling him to download the app, and he kept putting me off. So one day, I grabbed his phone, and I downloaded the app for him. I went on vacation, and I kept telling him to listen to it. He was kind of put me off. I came back from vacation. He comes to my cubicle, and he says to me, hey, man, I've been listening to Terry and Jesse's show, and it's great. And it's made a big impact in his life. The guy, he's going to weekly adoration a couple times a week. He goes to the mass in the morning. Mm-hmm. He's an on-fire Catholic, and he promotes the Terry and Jesse show and the Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Wow. Daniel, what a testimony. And I want to encourage our listeners to get those cards by going to virginmostpowerfulradio.org and do what Daniel's doing. Go out and spread the faith by inviting people to listen to Virgin Most Powerful. Daniel, thanks for your testimony, brother. God love you.
You're welcome.
This This is Terry Barber reminding you there's a women's conference coming up September 7th, 2019 at the Sacred Heart Chapel. Mary Danielle Barber will be speaking along with Barbara Nicolosi. They're going to be talking about true femininity. Be who you are. This is going to be for your daughters, your mothers. Every woman should be at this conference. And the way to do it is go to virginmostpowerfulradio.org or call 877-526-2151.
Buying or selling your home or your business property? This is Terry Barber. Real Estate for Life underwrites the Terry and Jesse Show. And they can connect you to one of 900 pro-life real estate agents around the world. And when they receive their referral fee, they will give 80% of it to a pro-life organization. Wow! That's 80%! RealEstateForLife.org, 877-LIFE-US1.
Now, back to Hands-On Apologetics with Gary Machuda. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 888-526-2151. Here's Gary.
And welcome back to Hands-On Apologetics. We are chatting with Master Apologist Trent Horn. And when I say Master Apologist, I do mean Master Apologist, because Trent, you stuck it. I mean, you got all 3 points in right at the break, so you definitely are a pro.
Always trying to manage the clock when it's counting down. You should watch my a Protestant reviewer reviewed my debate with Dan Barker on whether the Christian God exists, and he was quite impressed. I unfurled 5 arguments, and then my opening statement ended exactly at 15 minutes when the timer rang. So always have to be mindful of the clock.
Hey, they should have an apologetics Olympics, and you know, see if you could stick the argument in a certain amount of time. Because you, my friend, would be a gold medalist.
Some apologists that would take the gold, and others who would not even get on the podium if you put strict time limits on them.
Well, hey, you know, I was reading from our live chat, and what you said actually fits well with what they're doing on the chat room at YouTube. And namely that the pro-death arguments have moved from questions about humanity, because that's pretty much a done deal. The unborn baby is human, to this body rights argument. And you hear that a lot about, you know, this fetus doesn't have a right to impose itself on my body, that type of stuff. And ultimately, it almost feeds into a kind of contraceptive mentality that, the marital act is completely separated from life-giving love. And so the points that they were making was, you know, unless we deal with the contraception issue, we really can't solve the abortion issue. First, what's your opinion on that? And does that come up in the field when you're talking about abortion?
I'm sorry, you cut out there.
Artificial contraception, the separation of love and life. Does that come up in the field?
Yes. It certainly does. One thing that I think comes up is people will make a red herring. They'll say, well, if you're against abortion, then why aren't you in favor of promoting contraception? Mm-hmm. And so people will try to divert the argument, say you should be out promoting contraception if you're against abortion. And so what I do in these situations, I say, my goal is not to reduce abortion per se. My goal is to restore the right to life the unborn once possessed. My goal is to make it illegal to directly kill innocent unborn children. That is my goal. And hopefully by restoring their right to life and helping people see it's gravely immoral to kill the unborn, abortions will be reduced because people won't want to engage in this act. So I'll ask people, how does promoting contraception help me achieve that primary goal? And the answer is it doesn't in any way, shape, or form. In fact, as Pope St. John Paul II says in Gospel of Life, it can be antithetical to that goal, can create a anti-parenting mentality of thinking that the unborn are unwanted, that they're a threat to protect ourselves from, and that if they make their way past contraceptive protective barriers, then that makes it more likely for them to be aborted, actually. And so I was once actually at a university campus, and a guy said, why aren't you passing out condoms? And I said, well, I don't have to. The campus health center passes them out for free. Why would I have to do that? And he said, yeah, but that's on the other side of campus. I don't want to have to walk that far. And I'm like, well, you know what? If this guy can't walk 200 yards to get condoms, why would I consider him responsible enough to help a baby who is conceived through one of his shenanigans? So it's not an answer to the moral problem of abortion. It's a red herring and a distraction.
Yeah. So should that be a focus when we talk to people who aren't pro-life, that to remind them of the connection?
It depends.
Yeah,
I think it's something to bring up. But the problem is that pro-choice people will paint the narrative that pro-lifers want to go into their bedrooms and outlaw their birth control, outlaw certain things they'd like to do in the privacy of the marital bedroom, and paint us as these crusaders and fascist overlords. And we can't afford to feed into that mentality. I mean, Catholics can reasonably disagree, for example, over the question of whether pure contraceptives, ones that prevent conception, should be legal or not. I mean, even St. Thomas Aquinas made a case for prostitution being legal because outlawing it would lead to greater evils. Now, other people like St. Alphonsus of Liguori disagreed with him, and the church doesn't hold that view today on things like prostitution. But we can have different disagreements about the nature of contraception. I mean, about whether it should be legal or not. We Catholics have to agree that contraception is intrinsically evil and it's sinful. But when we're talking to people, we have to understand, look, a person, you have to see, what are they ready to receive? If you've got someone who doesn't even agree with the wrongness of killing an unborn child, it's going to be a lot further down the line for them to agree that contraception is intrinsically immoral. And the other church's teachings on sexuality, they may not be ready to receive that teaching. You can share it with them and help them see that it is reasonable and put that forward. But I think it's better to keep the conversation focused. And once you can get someone on the side of life, what's interesting is Patrick Madrid has an anthology called Surprised by Life about people who became pro-life and then became Catholic shortly thereafter. So I think focusing just on getting them to see the wrongness of abortion can help to turn their worldview enough that they're more predisposed to accept other elements of the Catholic faith.
Yeah, that's true. Because, the more truth that you embrace, it kind of sheds light on other issues and, keeps growing.
But if you give them too much, then they may shut down if you give them too much in one sitting.
Yeah, right. Yeah, because it'd give them a lot easier to kind of wiggle out into other red herrings, and the conversation doesn't go anywhere.
Right.
So is the property, body property argument, I don't know if that's the proper term, is that the main counter argument, or are there other counter arguments?
Oh, you mean the argument bodily autonomy?
Yeah, that's it. Yes.
There's three kinds of counterarguments to pro-life positions. Ones that don't talk about what the unborn are, ones that say the unborn are not persons, and ones that say a woman has the right to do what she wants with her body, even if the unborn child is a person. One thing that we didn't discuss is more specific, irrelevant ones. You can use trot at a toddler. It just applies in different ways. So, for example, people talk about back alley abortions. Abortion should be safe. You don't want women to die from abortion, so it should be legal. Once again, you can use a variant to trot at a toddler here. And I would say, yeah, I agree abortion should be safe. I usually tell people I'm fine with abortion if it's as safe for the child as it is for the mother. But that's not abortion. That's childbirth. And then people will say, well, it doesn't work like that. I'm like, well, exactly. That's why it shouldn't be legal. When I was at UC Berkeley, I got a guy really worked up in the audience because they're talking about back alley abortions. And I said, well, here's how the argument from back alley abortion goes. You're saying it ought to be legal for big people to kill little people, because otherwise it'll be dangerous for the big people to kill the little people. How does that make sense? And he was just mad I characterized it that way. But that's essentially the argument, and we need to get people to see that. And then once they see the moral flaw in the position, we can say, and look, by the way, it's not true that thousands of women were dying from illegal abortion prior to Roe versus Wade. And in 1972, it was like 39 deaths from illegal abortions and 25 deaths from legal abortions. That illegal abortion deaths were greatly exaggerated as part of a propaganda campaign to legalize abortion. We should say, look, it's tragic when anyone dies from abortion, whether it's a mother or whether it's her child or both. But the answer is not to make it legal for one of these innocent people to kill another innocent person. That's not the answer to the problem.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah, that's Yeah, even if you account for the fact that they're probably underreported because you know, the shame factor, it's still nothing compared to the what's in the popular mind of, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of women dying in back alley abortions.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I like that.
So it's,
the analogy you gave is almost like if people are getting injured robbing a bank with knives or something, let's give them guns so it's safer.
Or we should make terrorism legal so that the terrorists don't have to resort to suicide tactics.
Yeah, exactly.
Now I'm wary. I use these analogies with care because some people will say, so you're saying that a woman who's choosing to have an abortion is a terrorist. You have to always be careful with the analogies you use. And my point is, no, just as we don't make it legal so it's safer for born people to commit crimes or harm against other people, we ought not do that in contexts involving the unborn as well.
Yeah. Yeah, very good. Well, yeah, see, the problem is coming up with a counter analogy is taking the life of an innocent person is generally outlawed. So no matter what counter analogy you come up with, it's going to be bad, you know?
Right, yeah.
Like robbing a bank or a terrorist.
Yeah, and that's why with what I try to choose is essentially a mother ending the life of her newborn child at home after birth, like the killing of a newborn. I mean, it's the closest analogy we have to abortion. You have a very dependent human being whose parent or someone who helps the parent ends the child's life. Do you think that that's justified? And to show that there no analogy is perfect because, you know, pregnancy is unique. There's not really any other cases like that. The closest we can think of might be the case of conjoined twins, people who are born and they're conjoined to a twin. But even that is not really on par with a lot of things involved in pregnancy. So, but I think the analogies are still solid and they hold.
Yeah, yeah, very good. Well, hey, where can people get a hold of your pro-life stuff and all the other great things that you've written?
They can go to shop.catholic.com and also check out my books. They're available on Catholic retailer websites. The book I wrote on pro-life was called Persuasive Pro-Life. So if you want my book, best book on the subject, the largest treatment I have on this subject would be Persuasive Pro-Life by Trent Horn.
Very good. And is there, I know you do the Council of Trent broadcast.
Yes.
Why don't we talk about that too?
Yeah, go to trenthornpodcast.com and you can see my website there, trenthornpodcast.com. If you click on the tags, you can see the tag for abortion. I've covered abortion in many episodes, and I actually had a few dialogues with pro-choice individuals, long-form dialogues on the podcast itself. So go to trenthornpodcast.com, click the abortion filter tags to see the posts are tagged with different things, and you can find some of those, and those may be very edifying.
Awesome. Yeah, great stuff. Thank you so much, Trent, for coming on the show.
Of course. Anytime, Gary.
All right. Trent Horn, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, pick up his book. Visit his website. Trent's got everything that Trent writes in apologetics is gold. So I highly recommend everything he's written. But it's such a useful book to have for, you know, answering those tough questions about, you know, pro-life, pro-choice. How do we answer? So anyway, coming up tomorrow, we have Master Apologist William Albrecht. And also a kind of different pro-life issue of the Immaculate Conception of Mary. That's going to be a lot of fun. And, boy, this is the fastest hour in Catholic Talk Radio, I swear. It's already time for us to shut down the Midwest Command Center and turn off the dojo lights. And, you know, it's been great that you came and joined. Thank you for listening to the program. Coming up next, High Impact Catholic Talk with the Terry and Justin Show. Thank you so much for listening, and God willing, we'll talk again tomorrow.
In the 1990s, I lived and worked in Hollywood. But when my wife Betty's mom took ill, we relocated to Orange County. And it was during this time in our lives that I converted to Catholicism. Once my eyes were opened to the truth, I couldn't learn enough about the faith. But I had less free time than ever, especially with a long commute. That's when I discovered the real value of Catholic audio. Listening to cassette tapes transformed my daily commute into a miniature retreat. And that's the beauty of Virgin Most Powerful Radio today. Since the podcasts are archived, you can listen anytime on our smartphone app. I know how listening to Catholic audio can bring you closer to Christ and His Church. So I encourage you to visit the App Store or go to vmpr.org and download the app today. It just might change your life. I'm Matthew Arnold for Virgin Most Powerful Radio.
Virgin Most Powerful Radio, sharing the gospel with clarity and charity.